terrific and understand the major weaknesses of evolution. Sitting next to me was a guy that was an evolutionist and absolutely wasn't listening to anything going on in the presentation until it got to the one fact that he was there to listen to. That one fact was we've never been able to synthesize in a natural environment proteins that could be the real building blocks of life as we know it. And we had with him a stack of papers this big of a study where in the laboratory they synthesized proteins under a proto-Earth environment at best they could guess, et cetera. And he was willing to pass those out to everybody. That guy was prepared. Okay, he heard the arguments. He was a chemist. So this gentleman with a degree from Princeton who was not an organic chemist and is absolutely not going to convince this guy on his own turf. If for no other reason, then a chemist will not yield on his own grounds to another anybody other than a superior chemist. In the same way that, you know, if you're an engineer, you're not going to let a homeowner tell you that your calculations are wrong. You're going to say, well, I appreciate your disagreement, young fellow, but I'm going to show you how the math works. If you don't get that, that's your fault, not mine. So what do we do? How do you talk to everybody from a young man or a woman who's just been trained in evolution, as we all are now, if you've grown up in the United States in the last 70 years, you've had some level of training in evolution. If you've grown up in high school in the last 20, you've been taught that more than you've been taught anything else about biology. Biology now, you open a biology textbook, it's basically an indoctrination course in evolution. It doesn't study a lot of the other stuff that used to be studied 30 years ago. I'm already sounding like an old man, aren't I? They were doing it more right back when I was younger. So how do we talk to these guys and gals? How do you talk to somebody from that high school level all the way up to a college professor? How can you speak in a way that they're going to hear you and are going to potentially, if not be convinced on the ground, at least go back with some significant doubts about whether they're right or wrong? Conversely, how do we know that evolution is not correct? We're kind of assuming that based mostly on our philosophical background, but is that in fact the case? So what I would ask you to do is, today, I want us to put our theism beliefs aside. I want us to say we are not intellectually, we're going to play the role mentally of being agnostic about this or evolutionary about this. Why? What's the consensus of the scientific community today? There's certainly no argument. The scientific community consensus is that evolution is the best model for the development of life on Earth. That's uncontested. It's uncontested. It's a consensus. It's not uncontested that that's the right theory. So what I want to actually do is, I think there's two ways to do this, or two things one must do to be convincing. One, only argue from what sources? Scientific sources that are accepted by evolutionists, particularly. And secondly, what else do you think is probably a good way to do it? It's ultimately going to be the real baseline, if you think back to that second class. What was...
philosophical?
Yes, we're going to talk about the philosophical assumptions. We're going to ask questions pointing to the philosophical assumptions that are there. And I think that it'll be revealing. So, unlike last time where I gave you a huge amount of data that was relatively scientific, there's going to be almost none of that in here. I'm going to use one example here and that's it. The rest of it are going to be quotes by evolutionary biologists, physicists, etc. Now, what's the number one problem with quoting somebody from a particular perspective? What's the immediate accusation that you get?
Chicken.
Exactly. You're quote mining, you are taking it out of context, etc. Now, keep in mind that every quote that you see by an evolutionist in here, which is going to seem very damning of the evolutionary perspective at times, these guys still believe that is the correct model. So even if it seems like they're undermining it, the immediate retort is, well, obviously it's not that big a problem for it because that's what they believe is the truth. That's true. But what we're going to look for, I would ask you to look for in here, is a little bit of a pattern. We'll start with Charles Darwin. I picked this photo because this is Darwin. Darwin's thought this photo was hilarious. He said to somebody else, he said, if this is the expression that's always, I'm paraphrasing here, but this is the expression that's usually on my face. It's a wonder I have any friends at all. And I think this is one of his earlier photographs, lithographs, etc. And he looks hilarious in this one. But Charles Darwin said this about fossils, which you've heard before probably. The number of intermediate varieties which have formerly existed must be truly enormous. Why then is not every geological formation and every stratum or layer full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this, perhaps, is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory, and he was referring to the theory of evolution. This is from his work on Origin of Species, the 6th edition from 1902. That's interesting, but what he's saying is, at the time, the fossil record doesn't seem to back this theory. What is the retort to that? What do you know is often said by evolutionists on this particular topic?
The retort to that is that fossils are not preserved. They're not preserved consistently over certain ages.
Right.
So we shouldn't anticipate that there would be a clear link that traces back to, you know, a single ancestor.
Right. It's the fossil, exactly this. This is the why. The what is the fossil record is extremely spotty. So, you know, if it's this long, we've only got little spots here and there. So you wouldn't expect to see those. Now, what did Darwin expect would happen over time? That we would find these forms, and transitional forms would be allowed. And that's the story that we have today. Is a lot of these transitional fossils have been found, a lot of the gaps have been filled, but it's necessarily a very spotty record. Why is it a spotty record? How do fossils form? And what conditions do they form? If you think about it, if you hit a deer on 28, it will not form a fossil. Why?
It's just Midwestern mud.
It'll decompose before. There's no way to preserve it. So fossils are only preserved in conditions where they're quickly buried, usually with a water and mineral content, and they're sealed off from other, rapidly sealed off. Now, of course, the creationist says, well, that's what floods do. And the truth of the matter is most of the fossils are found to be kind of flood-based burials. But there's nothing that says that's a global flood, it just says that they are floods or events that are similar, catastrophic events that bury these fossils. But the anticipation of the day was, that's all right, the fossil record will be filled in over time. This is Dr. David Rout, who's a PhD from Harvard. He taught at Caltech, Johns Hopkins. He was a curator and dean of science for the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. This guy's museum curator, he's a director, and he's obviously got some relatively heavy creds, and he's an evolutionist. This is what he said in 1979. We have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition today than we had in Darwin's time. Now, look at that statement and think about it for a second. What's the major question that leaps to mind?
Why?
Second?
Why?
Yeah, or and what specifically? Why? Well, why is, okay, two major questions. That's a great one.
Why, what was eliminated from Darwin?
How do you get less with more fossils? That doesn't make any sense at all. That makes no sense at all. Well, the reason is that which were being identified as transitional fossils, even back in Darwin's time, we later came up to believe that these are in fact not transitional. They were species of their own that had, in the evolutionary account, risen and died out with no linkage to later ancestors or later descendants like us.
Some of them were mistakes and some of them were hoaxes too.
There are a huge number of hoaxes, and we'll fill in some of the data that we're not giving you here in this conversational approach. But as an example, ancestors to man, direct transitional fossils to man, how much do we have? Do you know how many skeletons and how many rooms it would fill and all that kind of stuff? Do you lay them all out on this table? That's how much we've got. That's not what it sounds like. I mean, we think like, well, we found an Australopithecus africanus, or Australopithecus afarensis, or Cro-Magnon man, or Neanderthal, or all these other ones. The parts that we get of them are like it's a skull piece that's this big. The Australopithecines are the most complete ones, but there's debate about is this a ground walking or tree swinging monkey? I mean, do we even know if it's any evolutionary chain of man? Even if you count Lucy and all those, that table right there holds them all. So it's a small amount of evidence that's being, or data that's being interpreted as evidence. This should ring some bells from the second class as well. This is not a picture of Dr. Mark Ridley, otherwise he is in an earlier evolutionary form. As he wrote this book, but there are Google images failed to yield anything at all. Now, by the way, when you quote anybody, always do what? Where do you go?
Citation.
Citation and where do you go? Do you take, so I pull all of these from one creationist site because they've just done a good job of aggregating them. Do you take a quote from a creationist site? Why not?
Because they have an agenda.
The creationists do have an agenda. Let's be honest. Creationists have got an agenda. We, if we're putting on a creationist hat, want to look at science and say, I believe God created the earth, so what do we end up naturally doing as human beings? We look for the evidence that supports our conclusion, we become dismissive of the evidence that counters our conclusion, and that's how we sift and sort data. Creationists and evolutionists are very guilty of quote mining, which is they'll go through a chapter or a paragraph, they'll gain one quote, they'll slap it there and say, look what happened, this is the truth right here. When right before it or right after it, there's a lot of stuff that says that's not what we're really saying here, it's just taken out of context. So with each one of these quotes, what I did was go back to the original work, cite the primary source, and make sure it's not being taken out of context. So you'll see a couple quotes that I'm going to use later, especially by guys like Dawkins, that you often get one part of it, but you don't get the other part. But even the one they complain about doesn't really change the meaning of the quote. So, at any rate, this is interesting, I think. This guy's PhD from Oxford. His doctoral advisor was 1H Richard Dawkins. And he is currently in the Department of Zoology in Oxford. So this guy does animals in Oxford. No real evolutionist uses the fossil record as evidence in favor of the theory of evolution as opposed to special creation. Now, why would he say that? He's quoted in the New Scientist in June 1981 saying this. Why would he say that?
Data.
There is simply insufficient data. If you're going to get into an argument about somebody believing in special creation, the data is not helpful in this case. It's not enough, and the creationist is going to be able to overcome you with his amount of evidence. Now, interestingly, you don't see, these quotes get rarer and rarer, more and more and more rare over time. Evolutionists have figured out that if you say it, it's going on the internet, and you got to be careful because, and as a result, it's become, if anything, a little more strident. So too have the creationists. Richard Dawkins, I have no introduction required. This guy is not on Team Theist, as you well know. This is him talking about the Cambrian explosion. A brief background for anybody who doesn't know. If you dig through the geologic column, as we understand it or estimate it today, you've got all these different life forms. You do seem to see like men and mammals and stuff like that at the higher levels. You seem to see more aquatic stuff or earlier life forms at the lower levels, but it's not this tree, this Darwinian tree that got drawn. What it is all of this stuff like this, and then there's this cutoff point, and there's some small single-cell organisms below that. So it looks like we're missing a huge amount of data. The creationist said, you're looking at creation right there. That's where all this creation happened. It's over what appears to be a 100 million year period if the geologic column is correct, if our assumptions are correct about it. And all of the major phyla, so if you remember doing the Linnaean system of kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, that second major group, phyla, all of it was present right there in a heartbeat of evolutionary time within about 100 million. Very difficult to explain from an evolutionary perspective that says single common ancestor and modification of divergent over time. This is what Richard Dawkins says in The Blind Watchmaker. It's as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. That's normally where the quote ends. He complains that we don't, or that creationists don't, you know, steam on one of these. Don't include the other one. Evolution, this is the red. Evolutionists of all stripes believe, however, this really does represent a very large gap in the fossil record. Just based on that alone, what questions do we ask? So the quote that Dawkins often gets pulled, plus what said part he says, you should have included this when you quote this slide. What does that say to you? Or what question do you want to ask?
Why is there a gap?
Why do you think there's a gap there?
Well, it's the assumption he has a model. And my model says there should be more data. So there's, you know, what you talked about before about there's a presumption going in, and the presumption is my model is correct. So you don't work, and this is true of everybody, you don't just work from the data to develop your hypothesis. Sometimes it's a circle. And once you've got your hypothesis and you've grabbed onto that model, things that don't fit, there's biases that come into play where things that don't fit, I can't abandon my model that I've spent my whole life.
And by the way, I've asked for him to step in a little bit extra in this class. So if he's talking more than is normal, that's exactly what I've asked for. So let's keep doing that because he studied some of this particular stuff. Exactly that. And What else? What other questions were you asking?
I think it's worth saying that, you know, he mentioned that what I think is a key word, which is bias. I think everybody comes to the table, regardless of what your position is, everybody comes with bias.
Right. So let me ask this question. You often hear this, especially from National Academy or National Association for the Advancement of Science. Evolution is a fact. It is as well established as the fact that the Earth is round. In fact, there was a large population of people that signed a petition to that agreement, to that effect, that were scientists. So they've signed exactly that. Let me ask you the question. Is a smoking gun evidence or data? There's a murder, a dead body, and a smoking gun.
It's data.
It's data. What do you have? What does it become evidence? What makes it into evidence?
An association.
An association with a model, a hypothesis. I think Scott shot this guy. Or Ike, who's not here, I'll pick on you. I think Ike shot this guy. It's not now. It's still not evidence for that conclusion yet. Once you get that it's Ike's gun or that Ike's fingerprints are on it, now smoking gun plus Ike's fingerprints or Ike's ownership plus dead body, those three data points or four data points now fit a particular model better than they do the model that Tracy did it. So the difference, yes, sir?
When did the theory of evolution stop being called the theory of evolution? You just alluded to people thinking it's a fact, or stating it's a fact.
It's hard to identify exactly when that happened, but there was a major, the very, very, very brief 10-second history of this is Darwin, that's not true. The idea of evolution goes back to ancient Greek and Roman times, that people had speculated that life arose out of the sea back then. This is not a new idea. What Darwin did was, he was the first to give a mechanism to what might have done that, natural selection, and that second part, which is actually critical, random mutation, didn't raise its head until we started understanding what genetics were. Back in Darwin's time, the cell was a glob of junk. Even 50 years afterwards, that's what it was. But what happened was somebody realized that there's fossils around. This is in the 18th century-ish. And the question was, where are they coming from? Some people said, well, God put them there. Some people said, flood relics. It wasn't until a debate arose in the 19th century, really, between 18th and 19th century, between catastrophists and gradualists, or uniformitarians. And the question was, is the Earth really young, which was the assumption all the way up till then, 6,000 years, and the Bible was the one describing it. Or could it be really, really, really old? That's the other possibility, is it's really, really, really old. And you'll hear evolutionists say, when with the rise of science, we started to understand that the Earth, the universe, the solar system is ancient, and thus our models need to reflect that fact.
So say too, when you say evolution is a fact, there's a significant distinction between microevolution and macroevolution. And macroevolution remains a theory, correct?
Yes. Right, and even the mechanism for microevolution can be argued to be a theory as well. But that's exactly right. The difference of data and models is really what we're talking about. Remember, that's the same problem with cosmology. Hey, my model says either one of two things. Or my model could say one of two things. We're at the center of the universe, or the universe looks uniformly the same from every point in space. Which one do you prefer? Back to what she said earlier, it's a philosophical assumption. I prefer this one for reasons of X. Boyce Rinsberger said, I pulled two things from him. I forgot to tell you who he is, but does more writing on the subject of evolution than any of the necessary scientists, but he said this. And I pull this one up because this is one you've seen in your textbooks as one of the best examples of evolution. Is one of the most well-known transitions is the horse evolution transition. It's still in textbooks today. The popularly told example of horse evolution, suggesting a gradual sequence of changes from four-toed, fox-sized creatures living 50 million years ago to today's much larger one-toed horse, has long known to be wrong. Instead of gradual change, fossils of each intermediate species appear fully distinct, persist unchanged, and then become extinct. Transitional forms are unknown. This guy is absolutely not on Team Theist. He writes books on evolution. He does advocacy for evolution. How do you arrange, what makes you say, as Eugenie Clark did, who is works with that same Society of Advancement of Science, she says every form is a transitional form. Every fossil is a transitional fossil because you're moving from one place to the other. But one, that's not correct. I mean, there are distinct evolutionary lines, even in evolution, so that's blatantly wrong. But most importantly, what they're saying is, basically, you can take frog, lizard, Archaeopteryx, bird, an ancient bird, chicken, and because they share some characteristics, you line them up and say, you see, these are transitional forms. And then they have to fit within there. Archaeopteryx, I think, is one of the most popular ones everybody's heard. I didn't put any quotes in on it. The same thing. Nobody believes Archaeopteryx is a transitional fossil. Zero people believe that anymore. Or, correction, nobody on the cutting edge of evolution anymore in the mainstream of evolution believes Archaeopteryx is a transitional fossil, but you still find it in textbooks someday, sometimes today. It's a distinct evolutionary line that doesn't lay between reptiles and birds. So I included the second quote of his because I want to ask you a question about it. First, there's absolutely no controversy within science about the reality of evolution. Now, there are two major points to glean from here. What's one of them?
Absolutes. Are you talking absolutes?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's wrong.
Bingo. All right. That's the most succinct version of it. Now, why is it wrong? Why is it wrong to me? Why is I, as an evolutionist, let's say I'm an evolutionist, why would I say that's wrong?
Because it says within science, and science is just the study of things that people can test, repeat, and verify, and that sort of thing. So whether a scientist is Christian, whether they believe in evolution, or whether they don't, if they're studying science or doing what, fulfilling that definition of what science is, then that would make that not true.
So what's the only way to make this true?
Everyone.
You have to bound. You have to bound evolution pretty narrowly, yeah. And you have to, you know, it's kind of like your micro versus macro is a huge distinction that isn't acknowledged at all there. When you go, look, in the micro, can we observe this over time with, you know, within a family, closely studied in the laboratory kind of stuff where you can see, or within an environment over time, you can see some of that. It's really hard to refute that. But Cambrian explosion, those kinds of things, that implies if this is true at the micro scale in recent history and science, then it's true all the way back to the dawn of time, and it's the same model that propagates. And that's not, there's a lot of assumptions built into that.
Right, and the question, and this is where, and I'm going to springboard off that, I wasn't going to say this till later, but what he just said is important with respect to this. You cannot say evolution is impossible. It's not impossible. It could happen. It is theoretically possible, based on the physics that we believe in today, that a person can materialize. I'll tell the Big Bang Theory joke. A physicist comes into an ice cream shop every day and he orders two sundaes, one for himself and one for the empty chair in front of him. And he's done, does this for a month, and finally the proprietor gets curious and questions him, why did you do this? Why do you keep doing this? Why are you buying two sundaes? He goes, well, quantum mechanics tells us that it's possible that a beautiful young woman could pop into existence right here from a confluence of virtual particles all flexing back and forth in the quantum vacuum. And so I'm buying an extra sundae there just in case she does pop into existence, and then I'm kind of on her good side already. And he says, hey man, why don't you just ask one of these pretty young ladies that comes in here all the time out? And she might tell you yes. He goes, yeah, what are the chances of that? So that which is, you know, we as human beings make judgments on the possible and the impossible, but based on probability, which is what really gave rise to one of my wife's key disciplines of statistics, you know, which is based fundamentally, obviously, probability theory. But to tell an evolutionist that there's something that is irreducibly complex, it cannot happen by a series of gradual steps, that's not true. It could happen by a series of gradual steps. Is there any evidence that it happened from a series of gradual steps? Is the probability one that you're willing to swallow? Those are different questions. And we'll see why do we swallow these probabilities. But let me go back to something earlier. There's no controversy within science about the reality of evolution. That is a true statement if you prescribe the bounds of science to include only those people who believe in evolution. So anybody who believes that says intelligent design or creationism or anything that includes the supernatural, if they're saying supernaturalism, the belief in the transcendent is automatically excluded from the realm of science, then this statement becomes true. That's his mentality when he says it.
That's your no true Scotsman tautology.
That's exactly right.
If you believe in, if you are a scientist, then you believe in evolution. Therefore, within science, the reality, there's no question, no controversy with the reality of evolution.
Everybody get that? That is exactly right. And when you're talking to an evolutionist, if we are questioning an evolutionist, this is exactly the mentality that's adopted.
So you're saying they believe there's no controversy because there is no other alternative idea?
Folks that are doing exactly that. People who believe there's only really one counter to there's one that they'll even occasionally acknowledge as semi-credible, which is intelligent design, and they say that really lies outside the bounds of science. That's disguised creationism. Creationism is religion. Religion is not science. Therefore, anybody saying ID is not doing science, they're doing religion. We're scientists. We believe in doing things with the natural world only. Which is not, now that there's some, what do you grant the person there? I mean, why is that not a bad idea?
You want to limit what is allowed in your scientific communities because, you know, you get into the flying spaghetti monster argument of, well, I believe in the flying spaghetti monster, so I think that this should be taught in school because I believe it. And you have to be careful how wide you open that aperture for being allowed in the scientific community.
Yeah, there's a limited amount of room in a textbook. What theories are you going to put in there? Are you going to put the Earth is flat theory? There are people out there that profess to believe in a flat Earth. Do you let them have credibility and time in your textbook? Probably not. We're going to say that's so improbable. It's so outside of science. So what we've basically said is science only includes that which has a naturalistic explanation. So I'll say that again. Science only includes that which has a naturalistic explanation. What does that tell you about science? Can it cover everything? It has a limit. And that's hence the title, and we'll get into that later.
It tells you it has a supernatural bias.
Right. So this gets to the level of philosophy. There is a philosophical assumption underpinning evolution, particularly in scientism, is what it's called. It says there is no transcendent. So in a guy like this neurophysician who writes a book recently about his experience when he was in a coma, no higher brain function going on at all. Stuff that normally goes on in the higher brain function, he has his memories from that period when he was out. Okay, his explanation is, I'm a neurobiologist, I don't believe any of this nonsense. Having had the experience directly, I'm telling you that the transcendent does exist. Experience sounds a little crazy, but what are you going to say? Professor E.J. Whitaker, not really famous, but he's a fellow of the Royal Society, he's a professor of botany at Cambridge, so his creds are pretty decent. He says this in 1961, to the unprejudiced, the fossil record of plants is in favor of a special creation. Now, why do I bring this point up? Not to say special creation is right, but remember what other people have said in the past. There's no evidence at all, no evidence anywhere for special creation, for creation, or for God. How do we say evidence? You know, everything's data. It's only evidence when you stick it to a model. So what someone is saying when they say that is, there's no data you can stick into the creationist model that then acts as evidence. Well, this is a evolutionist saying, at the end of the day, not only is there evidence that fits in there, more of the data fits the evidence for special creation even when it comes to plant evolution than it does the theory of gradualism of evolution. Now, by the way, a lot of these quotes that we're pulling are in the debate between gradualism and what was called brain lock. Hopeful monsters is the pejorative term, but it's a punctuated equilibrium. Stasis, 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 stasis. Huge amounts of changes in short period. Stasis, stasis, stasis. Because that's what the fossil record shows. There's a lot of stasis with major changes happening in very, very short periods of time.
The Cambrian explosion, is
that? Yeah, we mentioned that one earlier. That's an example. Actually, that's a mega example of state of non-existent data or very slim data and then everything all at one time. So that's even beyond that. Dr. DMS Watson, all really good writers have three names before their last name. He's a general professor of zoology and comparative anatomy at the University College of London. The science building there is named after him. That's how highly respected the guy is. He says this, and this is one of the last quotes I'm going to throw at you. Evolution is accepted. Not because it can be proved by logically coherent evidence to be true, but because the only alternative, special creation, is clearly incredible. I can't lend credence to it because it doesn't make sense to It doesn't make sense how. Philosophically. Right? He's saying scientifically, I can't make an argument for evolution, but there's only one other possibility. Alright, another one from Dr. Dawkins. And here's where I'm giving you some more evidence of the, or some more examples of the data, evidence, model type of thing.
So, before we, I'm sorry,
yes,
before
sir.
We leave Dr. Lawson, how, I mean, to me, this is the fundamental argument.
Yep.
I mean, if you're disputing the evolutionist, the reason he's disputing you is because the only alternative is the existence of God, that is outside of his purview. That means he's out of control, and there is a God who is in control.
Well, you're getting exactly to the fundamental point.
So, how accepting, I mean, do, if you put it to those words, to a real fundamental evolutionist, how do they respond to that?
That cuts both ways. What you're doing is, and this is, you're going to hear this term thrown out a lot, the God of the gaps reasoning. If you believe that there's stuff that happens transcendently, that somebody can just monkey with the physical processes we have today, then anything is possible. I mean, you can make any theory in the world work. Hey, the earth is flat. It just looks spherical when you put things up because God makes it happen that way. Can't disprove it, right? Freudian psychology, another great example. Any bit of data fits into that model's evidence. I killed this guy. Your mom didn't give me enough attention. I didn't kill this guy. Well, your mom didn't give you enough attention, but you know, good bit of data, right? When we're looking at why, it's a fact that this is really a dichotomy, and at the most fundamental level, this is the truth. It is either one or the other. So far. Because there's no other theory other than evolution. There's no other naturalistic theory other than evolution. Why? How do you even come up with another? What's another one that makes sense?
Aliens.
Well, actually, that fits within evolution. You're not going to believe this, for those that haven't studied it, but directed panspermia and panspermia are ideas. Do you know why we're looking for life on Mars?
Prove that's where we came
from.
We're trying to look for a linkage.
Let me tell you exactly why we're looking for life on Mars. You're not going to get this in here. I'm going to make assertions that are supportable, but not with the data that I brought with me today. The evolutionists, when they're looking at the probability of this will happen, how does it match the fossil record? The fact that the tree of life has collapsed and they're calling it kind of like a web of life now, etc. The data are not supporting evolution happening even in the billions of years time frame that we've been given. What they're saying is abiogenesis, which we'll talk about in a second, does not seem to be possible by any mechanism with which we can invent. It's not credible. It's possible to see it from somewhere else. Now, we do have meteorites on Earth. We have meteorites on Earth that appear to be of Martian origin that have some interesting compounds in them. Whether those compounds originated in Mars, whether they originated in our contamination on Earth, you know, a big debate. But ultimately, the bottom line is, it doesn't look like it's happening here. It doesn't look like it could happen here. Maybe it happened on Mars first and then came here. Maybe you just pushed it back another level. But you kind of have to. I mean, if you're going to say, and if you're a real agnostic and you say, I'm not going to just believe in this God, I don't see any evidence for him, how do I go about doing these things? You have to figure out a way to make this work, even if it's hard. Now, some science does get done that way, but the best science, historically, doesn't seem to be when you fit data to your model and your model doesn't work, you fit your model to your data. That's not terrific science, and everybody acknowledges that.
And in fairness, that's looking for origin of life on Mars is a very logical next step. If you're a scientist and you acknowledge that my model does not work, but I'm not willing to go supernatural, extraplanetary is a, there's got to be something.
That's right. So the question is this, when the evolutionist makes this statement, well, there's just no evidence for God being directly involved in this stuff. You really have to ask the question, and I don't think you should ask this question. I think you do it at a lower level, and that's what we're going to do at the end here. What you really should ask at that level is this. Let's read two things by Dr. Dawkins. Biology is the study of complex things that appear to have been designed for a purpose. Designoid objects, he called them designoids. This is what he coined the term. Designoids are objects that appear to be designed. Look designed so much so that some people, probably alas, most people, alas, why? Think that they are designed. These people are wrong. The true explanation, Darwinian natural selection, is very different. Now, the problem is, when you make statements like this, if I'm a real agnostic, I'm not committed either way, my inevitable conclusion, or my inevitable question should be, Dr. Dawkins, if you're saying it looks designed, why do you not take that as evidence of design? Or alternately posed, Dr. Dawkins, if design were the origin of these things. And let's not say theistic design. Let's say alien life design. And more advanced race of aliens designed us. What evidence would you need to see in order for that to occur? And I think that what you say is, well, there would be an appearance of design in there. Now, this is the most striking evolutionist potentially on the planet today, telling you that things in complex biological systems appear to be designed, not just designed, but designed for specific purposes. That, to me, as a guy who's saying, I'm going to throw the theism away for a second, I'm going to try and think about it evenly, says to me, I've at least got to put some weight of data on the design hypothesis over here. And there's a bunch of data over here. Now, here's the other problem. You got the scales, evolution side of the scale, design side of the scale, what data goes on each side. I mean, Dr. Dawkins is laying claim to the eye as evidence of evolution. The intelligent design guy is laying claim to the eye as, bottom line is, almost the vast majority of the evidence could go on either side of the scale depending on your model. So this is why I don't like attacking models at the data level, at the evidence level.
Would it help having a solid definition of just the word evidence between the two different groups?
I think so as well. But even with what I've argued is, I didn't argue, Dr. Craig argued as, and I've adopted it, as a good definition of evidence, is the Bayesian definition of evidence, which is, simplified, basically says, this data makes a hypothesis more probably true than that hypothesis just based on the background information. So it does, but the problem is that same evidence, the evidence of the eye, as an example, depending on how you construe it, you can say that data makes evolution more probable than just the background information alone, or it makes creation more probable than the background information alone. So the question, I actually think that sometimes there is data out there. The geologic column is a great example. Absolutely, can you fit the geologic column structure into both models? Both of them have to really bend over backwards to do it. It doesn't fit either model perfectly. But it does, depending on how you're looking at it, it fits this one better or it fits that one better. But guess which way you usually fit it? Guess which way you almost always fit it? The direction of the hypothesis you're trying to prove. The reason I'm bringing these up are these are bits of data that are not fitting the model of the hypothesis they're trying to prove, and they're admitting it. Now, by the same token, there are designers, intelligent design guys, that say, look, here's data that doesn't fit. And Lucetus Natans does seem to be evidence in support of evolution, and it doesn't fit the creation model as anywhere near as well as it does the evolution model. The question is, who's got the preponderance of evidence? That's absolutely up to interpretation. You will never, ever, ever in a million years argue one person or the other off of their opinion based on an aggregation of data. So how do you do it? What's going on here based on what we said on class two? What level are they talking about? They're already down in the, we're making observations, we're looking at evidence, but what optic are they using? So if you look at the fifth line down, we've created our belief about, we have a belief of what optic you should use. I'm looking through the optic of theism. I'm looking through the optic of objectivism. I'm looking through the optic of evolutionism. I'm looking through the optic of naturalism. What optic do I use to look at this data?
Your belief.
Your belief about what it is that you trust in order to reason actually informs that. Now, that's the weird thing. Most people don't. This is what I'm saying. Everybody gets these levels pretty well. Now, this makes sense. This is science. This is how we do science. The line from the parenthesis up, from the parentheses up, is philosophy. And we don't usually do that very well in science. So we don't understand that it fits there. Even Dr. Stephen Hawking, which nobody can accuse of being a dummy, right? A guy smarter than all of us in this room put together, doesn't get it that philosophy is happening above that level. His most recent book, The Grand Design, one of his earlier pronouncements in the book, I think on page one or two, is that philosophy is dead and science has taken it over. And then he spends the next two chapters making philosophical arguments without using a shred of scientific data anywhere. He's just making philosophical arguments. So where do you get that level of blindness? Hawkins, not an idiot, brilliant. He will dictate 14 pages of equations to his stenographer, secretary, and he'll say, back up to page 7, I made an arithmetical error on line 12 of page 7. And the guy is frighteningly intelligent. But why can't he see that?
I think it's an agenda. It seems like it's an agenda.
He can only look through the eyeball that you got.
Now, and Scripture addresses that.
Which says what?
The God of this world has
right up. Which is why do we have varying controls over the eyes? Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I was actually at an apologetics conference last weekend. I don't know if you guys remember when Scott had a video of Dawkins and a guy named John Lennox up.
Yeah.
And Dawkins was saying that there's no faith is without evidence. And Lennox said, well, do you have faith in your wife? And Dawkins said, yes. He said, do you have evidence for it? And faith said, yes. And Dawkins' argument kind of fell out from under him at the time. Well, John Lennox was speaking at this conference. And he talked about a recent exchange he had with Dawkins, where Dawkins made the comment that religion is a fairy tale for those who are scared of the dark. And then Lennox quickly responded that, well, I think atheism is a fairy tale for those who are scared of the light. And if you think about it, I think it kind of ties in here. In another session I was listening to, Danny Frank Turek said that, you know, the elephant under the carpet in all these discussions for a lot of folks is the implication of a supernatural character of a God, which would be that God would have moral authority.
Yeah.
Right? So I think... I don't know Richard Dawkins, and he may have an argument strictly, and his whole bias may be purely from just believing that the evidence points to not being God. But it also could have something to do with the fact that he may not like the moral implications that come from there being a God, and as a result having bias in his philosophy.
So I'm going to get back to this. So think about this, put this in the back of your mind where we have the next couple of minutes, and we'll come right back to this at the end. Let me give you an argument in favor of arguing, of being very open-minded. At Will's class, this brilliant Princeton grad is giving a terrific presentation, and this guy brings up the point that he does. As is the want of a person who's teaching a class, you don't really like to give ground in front of the class because then it seems to impeach your knowledge, and they're only here because maybe you have more knowledge than they do. They might not know, you don't know as much, and everybody in the class leaves. You know, it's this bizarre fear that everybody has of standing up in front of somebody else, and you're going to find out I'm actually a dummy, but they're going to want to come back and listen to me. That's not that guy's problem. Obviously, he's brilliant. But as soon as this guy brought up an objection, he tried to quash it immediately. Now, let me tell you, the atheist was absolutely right. The atheist in the back of the class, his point was correct. There is no example of being able to generate proteins. Here's an example. With a paper of people generating proteins, what should the answer have been?
That's interesting. I didn't know that. I'm going to have to research that.
Right. And then let's say you want to maintain your point. What's the next thing you say? Terrific, for the sake of argument.
What kind of conditions did it take to be able to do that?
Or even better, yeah, you can go further if you want to. Let's grant it. For the sake of argument, I will grant that happened. Can you explain to me how you get from protein to a fully functioning cell? That's what I said to him in the back there. He thinks I'm an atheist, and he sent me an email with another guy that I was talking to at the same time. I'm going to ask to meet with him. I'm going to declare, hey, just so you know, I'm working on the other team. But let me tell you what I like about you. You have a dogged persistence of truth. Now, can you criticize the atheist for the point that he was making in that class?
Yeah.
Was the atheist more right than the creationist on that in that
yes.
class? Now, were the creationist arguments probably in aggregate more correct? I believe so. I think he did a great job of doing it. But if you're not willing to grant where they're right, you're wrong. You are wrong. You're just as wrong as they are at that particular point. So don't be afraid of it. Never fear truth. Because at the end of the day, if it is true that there is no God, don't you want to know that? Isn't that valuable information?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to turn into the fellow of the hunt. along with a lot of stuff. But it's, it's good information. Yes, sir.
It sounds like for both theories, I guess, the creation versus the, is that the, we'll call it evidence that defines, we don't find evidence that says one is impossible. It's just if we find evidence that says that, well, that this one's probably not likely, the explanation is, well, we haven't figured out how it all works together yet. But it seems like that's the same for both parts.
That is the same for both parts. Now, often, that's a good, I'm glad you brought that up, because I meant to say it earlier, and I didn't. The godly gaps accusation is absolutely a good one. All right, we see this point of data, we see that point of data. How did it happen in the middle? Well, God supernaturally intervened. That is detestable to the scientist, because what he's trying to say is stop doing magic in the middle of science. We don't see, you know, God's not intervening when I'm knocking this off, it's falling on the floor. So, you know, I'm going to describe that by physics. I'm not going to say, and then a miracle occurs and hits the floor. So can't you just get it, man? It's a, stop putting God in the gap. The problem is you got a lot of talking, or Darwin in the gaps here too. Hey, Precambrian explosion, or Precambrian period, Cambrian explosion, what's going on here? Don't worry about it. We're missing data. We'll either find it one day, or it's lost, but we'll understand how it goes. They have taken Darwin and just stuck him in the middle there and said, don't worry about that fact that we're missing that data. It will arise later. What they should say is, this is currently fatal to the theory. If it were the case that that doesn't exist anywhere, or it's it can't be explained, then, yeah, so both sides are guilty of it, often at times. But the Christian should never say this. Well, how do you think that this happened? Well, I guess God did. You don't know that. Remember the fine-tuning? It's actually possible that the Earth is this old. It's possible that the Earth is billions of years old. But God, with the aim of the world's greatest marksman, could have actually set off a Big Bang to do it. Remember, Big Bang was considered a creation thing. He could have fine-tuned it to all work out that way. And whether it matches the Genesis account, whether it's real or not, that's a question that we need to be asking. But when we turn around and say, no, we don't believe in that, we are being just as closed-minded as the other guys are. Now, if what you're going to say is, well, wait a minute, I do have evidence, scriptural evidence, that says that's not the case, I'm going to lay that out. Now you're introducing evidence, there's a good reason for you to do that. But if you're saying, I don't believe that Genesis necessarily excludes that, and we'll talk about that later in some classes coming up soon, then you were wrong to say it didn't happen that way. It could have happened that way. You don't know that. Unless God told you that personally. You don't know that. Or unless the scriptures are so clear that it can't be interpreted that way and still be true, then that's why I would say not to do it.
As much to, as the God of the gaps is inappropriate to throw in there too, it's also legit that a lot of these people were backing up intelligent design saying, hey, we're not just trying to fill in the gaps. We're saying that all this evidence for design points to a designer. We're following the evidence. And we believe that there's a designer here. We believe that that's where the evidence leads. We're not just trying to fill in the blank with God.
So that's why on the evidential level I'm saying, quoting guys saying it's design, and then putting the question back to the evolutionists to say, what would it take for you if it were design? If an alien did it, and don't go to God. If an extraterrestrial alien race did this, how did they go about doing it? What would be evidence for you?
The flip side of the intelligent design thing is, when you purport one of those positions and kind of throw that hypothesis out, don't follow it up with scripture. Because that, you know, right after that, you're basically tipping your hand and saying, well, this is my theory, and because it's in Genesis, that's why I believe it. You can't have that undercuts your discussion about having the debate on the evidence that exists.
But I would counter, and you may be right, but I would counter to say that both positions are based on partial data. Nobody was there. And no matter how much evidence that you bring up, you're either placing your faith in faith, key word here, you're either placing it in science, so-called science, or you're placing it in the word of God. And there's no amount of data that's going to convince somebody otherwise, is my humble opinion.
This is good. We should keep going on this. Let's go.
Okay. When you refer to it as so-called science and you do the things with your hands, you've just undercut the other person's religion. If I talk to you and I go, well, you're so-called God, now what are your feelings towards me?
Well, you know, it's an assault on your belief system.
defensive.
But so, yes, it is. Yes.
So this is actually really terribly important. What we're seeing here is there are facts. There are logical arguments to be made, and there are ways to make those arguments.
Right.
When you make an argument in a way that belittles the other person or their position, you're using a tactic, and he'll talk about tactics later in particular. You're using a tactic that is unlikely to yield you success. Now, back out of this for a second, and let's go outside, because in this class, remember what I've asked from day one is we're pretending at this point that we don't believe in the Bible yet. We haven't gotten there yet. We're still working our way through what is our philosophy that we can divine, what arguments can be made from zero. If we start from zero, where are we going? So by jumping, you're definitely right towards the end, and you're definitely right. Both of these positions have something to say at the end of the class. But for right now, remember, we got no Bible. Could be the Bhagavad Gita. Could be Buddhism. Could be the Quran. So we don't know yet at this point in the class, which is why this long period class is good. But this is terrific, and we will have this. We're going to unleash this one more towards the end of the program. Evolutionists have said this in periods where they thought they weren't being overheard. I don't understand why creationists hit any of the data that we've got anywhere. They auto-attack at abiogenesis because we've got no idea. Abiogenesis is a fancy word for spontaneous generation, which you've learned was destroyed by Louis Pasteur and his voice later. The bottom line is evolutionary theory has got nothing on how life got kick-started initially. The best they've got is, here's how you can get amino acids and proteins. That was a terrific argument in 1870. It does nothing for you today, zero for you today, because that's like saying, yeah, you can get a muffler and a camshaft. Great. Get to a car. How are you going to do that? That's how hard it is. Actually, that's several orders of magnitude more simple than a cell, one cell. The simplest cell on the planet is more complex than a car or a 747, which is why you hear that thing. Now, a 747 gambit is not correct. A whirlwind sweeps through here and puts a 747 together. That's not what evolution is saying. They're saying that it got built one small windstorm at a time. But it's still 747 at the end of the day before it can self-replicate. So here's Francis Crick. Now, of the Watson and Crick, Watson's a little more theistic. Crick, not so much. Doesn't believe in it. But this is what he said about abiogenesis. This is a Nobel Prize winner for the DNA molecule. Discovered the DNA code, which is really the big hammer. An honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. Dr. Dawkins says on The Greatest Show on Earth, we don't actually need a plausible theory of the origin of life. We might even be a bit anxious if too plausible a theory were to be discovered. Why would you make a statement like that? Why do you give the ground entirely?
He's almost just dismissing it out of hand.
Because? Yeah. Why would you? What's the because behind it?
I was thinking he was trying to downplay it.
Why would you downplay it?
Because there's no explanation.
You got nothing. The only reason to go there is because you got absolutely nothing. Now, why is it reasonable to have absolutely nothing if this happened? Why might you have absolutely nothing? You said it earlier.
There's no precursors for it.
Why would we not? If it did, let's pretend it did happen. Let's pretend we did evolve from a single cell organism that came from something. Why would we not have any evidence?
Oh, sorry.
Nobody's there, right? And it might not have been preserved in the early Earth, blah, 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 blah. There's reasons for it to not be there. The question now boils down to probability. Is it probable you can go from whatever you can make in the lab or wherever else to a functioning, replicating cell? Is that probable? And then from there, you're saying, is this engine of natural selection, random mutation, sufficient to explain the diversity of life we see today? That's another problem. But it's important to note that this problem right here is absolutely unsolved. And not only is it unsolved, it's conceded from the opposition. This is the point at which one attacks that. Now the fallback is what? What do you have to do if you're an evolutionist when it comes to abiogenesis?
Sure.
How do you explain that? What's your evidence that it did happen?
That it exists, that we exist.
Here we are.
Yep.
It must have happened. It's the same one of, did the Big Bang happen? Well, here we are, it must have happened. What are you doing when you do that?
Falling back on beliefs.
Is that begging the question?
It is, in fact. Well, it's not precisely begging the question, but overarchingly, it does. Yes.
This is an important pattern, though, because they had nothing on abiogenesis, the origin of life, the complexity of life, the origin of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe.
At this point, I'm going to make in two slides, and it's the critical point, and that's what we'll get to eventually here. That's very interesting. Let me give you one. So in case this was for those of you with a desire to have a little more science meat to it, let me give you a little meat. I like this one because it shows why evolution causes you to do a bad job of science. Now we put our theism hat back on. I'm going to go out as a theist. I'm going to tack one point here. What you're looking at here is soft tissue that was pulled out of a Tyrannosaurus rex fiber. Specifically a female pregnant Tyrannosaurus rex fiber. Dr. Mary Schweitzer, who is at NC State University from Montana, worked with the guy, you guys saw Jurassic Park, remember the paleontologist. The only guy that lived, pretty much, you know, all the way through there. He's been telling him the whole time, this is dangerous, this isn't going to work, and everybody gets eaten except him. The guy that was the inspiration for that character found is digging all kinds of stuff up in Hell's Creek, Montana. This is one of them. Now, he had to break this bone because it was on the side of a cliff in order to lift it out of the helicopter because it was too heavy when they put the cast on it. So this stuff falls out and he breaks the bone of it. He sends it to Mary. Mary, Dr. Schweitzer, sticks it, has her lab assistant stick it in acid. She leaves it in there a little bit too long and dissolves it. They're doing the chicken bone thing. Remember sticking chicken bones in vinegar and you can mend them a little bit? They're trying to take the minerals out of it so you can see the structure that would be left underneath it. So they did it a little bit too long. What they ended up finding was elastic stuff was in there. Now, when this was first put out, she said, it looks to me to be some tissue that produces certain things in the body. And eventually found more stuff that looks like blood vessels and red blood cells and all that kind of stuff. And there was an immediate backlash where everybody said, look, it could be biofilm, you guys have contaminated your stuff. It was a huge backlash. Then she was like, Roger that, but I did this like 20 times. They broke a whole bunch of dinosaur bones open, and guess what they found inside? Soft tissue. Soft tissue that is 68 million years old. Now, the limit for how old anything could be of organic nature, and this is where the organic biologists or the organic chemists hit the roof when this happened. They were like, no, not possible. It physically can't be done because everything will degrade. Collagen will degrade because of not just bacteria. Okay, got sealed up, there's no bacteria in it. Radiation. There's a whole bunch of other processes that go that actually make this stuff fall apart and turn into dust and other stuff. It didn't matter. They found in dinosaur after dinosaur after dinosaur after dinosaur soft tissue. It's there. Here's the problem. This is what Dr. Schweitzer, who, by the way, discoverer of the soft tissue, still an evolutionist, still believes in the time scale, says this. When you think about it, the laws of chemistry and biology and everything else that we know say that it should be gone. So what is the reply?
One counter to it is dinosaurs aren't as old as we ever.
So that's the obvious one. The creationists are giggling the whole time, being like, we told you. What does the evolutionist say? What do you have to say at this point?
That all of our laws are wrong. That's
exactly what they said is, it looks like we need to seriously rethink how long organic matter our assumptions about how long organic matter can last.
And this is why I use the term so-called science, because it's, you know, it shifts based on more revealed evidence.
I don't disagree with you. He doesn't disagree with you. He's making a tactical
suggestion.
But you're right. I mean, ultimately, here's my point. I'll skip down. We'll go back over this in a second. I'll skip down. Delays in discovery. If we weren't assuming that these were 68 million years old and stuff can't last longer than 100,000 years at the latest, what would we have been doing earlier? We'd been cracking bones open 80 years ago looking for this stuff. We'd have found that assumptions of evolution, in this case, impeded our progress of science. So when you hear an evolutionist say, like Eugene Clark has said on film, show me we are doing science. This is what's causing science to progress. What do you have on your side that has helped progress science? Your counter to it is, if you'd been working on our assumptions, you'd been opening bones up a long time ago and looking for this stuff. So we might have built a dinosaur by now. we might have T-Rex stomping around because we would have worked our way to get enough data that we'd have enough DNA, having cracked open enough bones, and when we did sequence the DNA and we learned how to transpose genes, we might be able to build one of these bad boys and get somebody eaten. I think was the ultimate, and it's ultimate, which I think was ultimately what we were trying to do. Yes, what were you saying?
It seems like they're just dead set on keeping their optic there and just having all the evidence just
absolutely
all around that optic.
But aren't we all, in truth? Yes,
sir.
Just taking a drink. Right. All right, so here's the problems with this line of thinking. One, it ignores that there's philosophy underpinning it. We beat that to death. It impedes the progress of science. One, it creates a Darwin in the gaps answer to everything that you don't have an explanation for. Don't worry, evolution is a powerful explanation. It'll explain it someday, which is, or to quote Dr. Dawkins, science is well on its way to explaining everything. My problem with Dawkins' statement is well on its way. If this is a mile-long trip, we're going on a micrometer in that direction. That's what well on its way means right now. To me, well on its way is I made it at least far enough that it's reasonable that I can see the end. It delays discovery, I just went over that. And it wastes effort. This is the real kicker right here. Phlogiston theory, Ptolemaic theory. You know, you can pour all the effort you want in the world of it. You can actually make a reasonable argument that says we actually haven't progressed in science at all for 2,000 years. What you can say is our technology has improved. But our philosophical view of science, our understandings of the universe, haven't changed fundamentally. The Greeks were talking about everything we're talking about now. Expanding universe, oscillating universe, eternal universe, universes that are limited in size, universes that are full in size, or are eternal in size. Non-deistic interpretations for their origin of life, theistic interpretations. All of this was being discussed 300 years before Christ and further. All of it. So you can make the argument we have progressed nowhere. We've got new tech that lets us know the stuff better, but we have progressed nowhere in science. You can make that argument. And I think another lethal objection that is philosophical in nature here is popular ethics and morality. Now, you will get nowhere with this one, so don't bother using it. Use it only as a counterpunch if you get punched in this direction. But when someone says, look what religion does, crusades and Inquisition and all that, You ask the question, can you have Nazi Germany and eugenics and without Darwin? You know, the answer is no. But what they normally say is, well, it's not Darwin's fault. He was just bringing the theory up. That's correct. It's not Darwin's fault necessarily. But it's an inescapable consequence of that, which is why do we breed our dogs for certain traits? Why do we breed our cows for certain traits? We don't breed our humans for certain traits. That's silliness. Why we're fools not to do that. And we ought to get rid of it in some way, whether we let them breed out or whether we take them out ourselves. We gotta clean up the gene pool for the sake of humanity. It's a great argument if that's your starting point. You know, that's the conclusion I would have come to. I don't know if I'd have picked on the Jews. I'd have picked on everybody who went redheaded. But the bottom line is, you run into philosophical problems very rapidly when you start on this level. So I was going to give us 10 minutes to do this. Obviously, we're already doing more discussion than I thought we were going to generate, so this is good. We've kind of done this. But what are the most important questions in life? Let's just throw them out. What do you actually want to know? Before you die, what do you want to know?
If there's anything after
death. Anything after death. What's another one?
Why we're here.
Why are we here? Why are we here? What else?
What's my purpose?
Do I have a purpose in life? If I have a purpose in life, what is it?
Where did I come from?
Now, what else? Are there any other ones? Just burning questions. If there was a God, you'd ask him. If there wasn't, if you could look at all of history, what would it be? What do you want to know?
What's the Powerball for next week?
What's the right? The future. Good.
How do I fulfill reason for being here?
Right. How do I fulfill my purpose? What's the point of all of it?
Does God exist?
Does God exist?
And if you're asking God, you say, why do we have evil? Why do we have good? Why is there morality? Like, kind of some of those things.
My point of asking these questions is, we ask these questions as theists. Atheists ask this question. Buddhists ask this question. Everybody wants to know the answer to this question. Here's my point on the limits of science over the last two sessions together is number three. Science can answer none of these important questions. There is no way for science to answer this. From a physics perspective, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle prevents us from knowing what happened early on, so the how. We can do a lot of the how back, potentially, but we'll never know how. We'll certainly never know why. Not from science. What else? Science can actually tell us very little reality. What I hope to give you over the last, what I hope to have given you over the last two sessions was just an indictment of science says it's got everything covered. In fact, it's got this much covered of a screen, you know, that's the size of this room. I just want to show you how limited science is in what we understand today. I love hearing people say, I've heard both sides say, we now know. I giggle every time I say that. Like, I'm going to record that on YouTube. We're going to go 20 years in the future, and I want to hear what you say when you say that. Because nothing of what people were saying 100 years ago are people quoting today is true. Einstein, anybody. There's no such thing as science without philosophy. It cannot be done because there are philosophical assumptions you have to make in order to do science. The some very basic ones. The world wasn't created 5 seconds ago with the appearance of age and memory in my mind. All right, so there's some obvious ones. You could argue that. How do you prove scientifically that's not the case? When you make it, and we mentioned it earlier, if somebody says, well, science is the only way, trustable way to understand the truth in this world or the nature of reality. Okay, that statement right there, the propositional statement, only science is good for the discovery of truth. Could you prove that scientifically? The answer is no. You have to make a philosophical argument for that. So philosophers, everyone's a philosopher. They just don't know it. You're a philosopher. You just don't know it. If you believe in a theology, you are absolutely a philosopher because you're not doing that scientifically. There's only one discipline left for doing that. It's called philosophy. Philosophy is, I'm not telling you you need to go take classes in philosophy. I just want you to understand that that's what's going on. And in what shall we place it? So have we destroyed every mechanism for understanding stuff? I mean, how do we discover truth? I mean, what do we place our trust? Remember, we don't have the Bible yet in this class. Now we've just got to figure out, what are we doing? How do we get there? And we go back to this. So with the top three lines really being philosophy, what do we at least have to, what do we have to start with? Where do we start? Where is zero? Where do we start from zero?
I think you start from a personal view and belief, a personal view of the world. I mean, you have to start, and I can't remember the philosophical name for it, the intrinsic view, the internal view.
Right.
And that's where you start, and that's the key. You know, you trust something, and you go out from there. And where you know, by the end of that sentence, people are in a lot of different places. But
right.
But it does start with you.
Okay.
I think it sounds like the foundation of what we started with is our optic. And maybe since that's the foundation, maybe that's why people have such a hard time removing that or replacing their foundation.
I agree with that. But I think that we gotta go even a little earlier than optic to get there. And to do what he's talking about here, this was, by the way, if your answer is stony silence, that's correct to some degree. We just don't think about this. We are not educated to think like this. We are not encouraged to think like this. This is about, I'll be looking at my wife now, so she can give me the high sign when I'm too close to time. There is no way that you should be expected to have been doing this before. The reason I ask you to do this now is, this is the way truth is discovered. This is how you separate doctrine from heresy. This is how you know whether Christianity is true. This is how you know what the foundations of science are. If you don't do those steps, you're already stepping halfway and downstream, and inertia will move you into your belief system, not good thinking. Now, do you have to start from I think, therefore I am? You do to some degree. Do you have to go and make a lifetime study of philosophy, i.e. do all philosophers, great philosophers, come to the same conclusion? No, they're in just as many places as the scientists, etc. The difference is from the I perspective. When you say, okay, you know what? There is a me, there is a world, and I observe things in the world. I can do one of two things, either pretend they're not real or assume they're real. If they are real, then there are two things that I can assume are real. These things that I reach out and touch, this kind of stuff out here, and stuff inside me I need to assume is real too. When you do stuff like that, you don't automatically throw out, you know what, I feel like that's wrong. And I can't get around it. That when you do things philosophically, you realize that the argument from morality or to morality both of those, are dependent on your innate, basic belief that it's wrong to rape 4-year-old girls. That there's just no way you can come up with figuring out a way to do that where it's okay, where it's something other than evil. And that alone, right there, that alone is enough to tip from naturalism to supernaturalism. When you make the arguments we made earlier in class, you know, about this is how you know there's a God, an argument from morality or a cosmological argument or whatever. That's why I'm encouraging you not to blow off those arguments. Those arguments are important. They are critical. And when you're talking to somebody, we'll talk about tactics to talk about tactics when you're talking to evolutionists. But I would encourage you to talk at the philosophical level, not the scientific level we're talking about. Not because you shouldn't be studying the science. I think it's interesting and fun, and you should do it. But you will get nowhere. The only way to get somewhere is to go back to this. Because think about it right now. Right now, don't you have a little bit of something in the back of your mind that says, huh, I've never really thought about it from this level, maybe. The fact that I haven't thought about this from the level makes me a little bit nervous. What if I'm wrong? If you're not willing, that same unwillingness you have to walk down that path, to dump your beliefs temporarily and go pursue things from zero again, that's how hard it is for the evolutionist to dump his belief system and come your way. And if you aren't willing to do it yourself, that's the end of time. If you aren't willing to do it yourself, what business do you have asking the evolutionist to do it? You have none. This is why I'm a big fan of saying, I'm not a Christian. I'm a guy who seeks truth. I think that I find truth in Christ. And it means that if you actually have a personal experience with Christ, a real one, there's no more reason to doubt that than there is a reason to doubt this, if your experience is unreal. There's a lot of Christians out there that haven't had that experience, but they convince themselves that they have. And ultimately, there's one other thing you can do, is if you come to the inside realization, you say, you know what, there might be a God. I think that there might be a God. Is it not reasonable to ask an omniscient God if he's there? And if you bare your heart and say, you know what, I really want to know the truth. Teach me whether this is true or not. If he's good, he'll show up. And if he doesn't show up, maybe he's not there. But be willing to do that. Okay. In the class, next time, are we meeting next time?
Yeah, relativism.
Relativism. So Will will be teaching a class on relativism. This gets right into the morality and ethics portion that are that is implied by these arguments. And I thank you for your patience on here. Now, let me take 10 more seconds, even though I'm getting the high sign, and ask this question. Are you guys getting what you need out of this class? Are we doing this in a way that gives you what you're after? Are we shooting above you? Are we shooting below you? Is this not important? Give me 60 seconds of feedback, please. Raise your hand if you're getting everything that you're hoping to out of this class so far, and then you're not going to get me personally. Raise your hand if there's stuff that you're not getting out of this class that you want to get. No, really? There's not stuff I want. I'm not getting stuff out of this class. I won't be here. All right. Hit us up. Let us know to adjust it. We will do it. I'll be hanging around for questions afterwards, so we will. Fresh off of a big apologetics conference, so we're brimming with new data. Definitely talking to you.
That I want